Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising.
Good morning. I have good news for you. If you're listening to this, we've survived the election of 2020. This episode drops on November 4th at 6 a.m., and I know yesterday was a long one. I decided to have this week's episode be a calming one, something to break up the anxiety and the routine and the noise that you're hearing in the media. Before I introduce our guest, I would like to ask all of you to connect with me on Instagram at devdebrief. On this account, I give updates and more information on the episodes, as well as headshots of the guests, and would love to have your support there. Please share with your friends and spread the word. This week, we talk about land conservation. I get the perspective of Andy Zepp, the executive director of the Finger Lakes Land Trust. Andy is a calming force as he talks about his plans for the land trust and his perspective on fundraising. We highlight the differences and similarities between higher ed and cause-based fundraising. Andy has worked in the land conservation field for more than 25 years. After graduate education at Cornell University, he worked with local conservationists to establish the Finger Lakes Land Trust. Say that four times fast. Andy has also worked for the Nature Conservancy's Central and Western New York program, first as the Director of Land Protection, and then as Associate Director and as Vice President for Programs for the Land Trust Alliance. He returned to the Finger Lakes Land Trust in 2003 to serve as its executive director. Zepp serves on New York State's Regional Open Space Committee, as well as the New York Advisory Board for the Land Trust Alliance. He also serves on Tompkins County's Planning Advisory Board and Strategic Tourism Planning Board, as well as the board of the SUNY-ESF Foundation. Now let's get started. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is our first conversation around environmental fundraising and this sort of piece of the pie of giving, so it's exciting.
Well, it's great to be here.
So you know a lot about, you know, fundraising for the environment, working in different kinds of organizations, and I know that you've worked at three similar but distinct organizations. I'd love to hear from your definition how they're similar and different to start to get a sense of your experience and your background.
Well, I started out working for the largest environmental nonprofit, I think, in the world, which is the Nature Conservancy. And I came about it in an interesting way. I grew up outside New York City and didn't know anything about the environment, but I went to school in upstate New York, Cornell, and really fell in love with the landscape and learned of this consensus-based, business-like approach to conservation, and ended up working in this field of land trusts. And these are essentially groups that don't tell people what to do with their land, but work with the community and landowners to come up with win-win strategies to conserve the land, whether that's raising the money to buy land and create a park, or use a tool called a conservation easement to limit development of land that remains private. And I broke into the field. I started out working for the Nature Conservancy, which has thousands of employees and is a global organization. And that really, I learned in my first fundraising there, even though I was really a program specialist. And then that really helped me learn working as part of a large team. And from there, I moved to Washington, D.C., where I worked for the Land Trust Alliance, that is essentially the nonprofit trade association for all these groups. And they have a very robust grants and foundation program. So I was very involved working nationally on designing large programs, securing the funding and implementing. And then I returned to Ithaca, where I now run the Finger Lakes Land Trust, to really combine these two experiences and working locally in the area, an area about the size of Vermont, to do on-the-ground conservation and really enjoy the fact that our world begins and ends in this area. So it allows a degree of focus and continuity that's a lot harder to come by when you're working on a national scale or a much larger organization.
Yeah, so it sounds like that broad range of experience has really given you perspective and ironically set you up to run such a huge, you know, physical piece of land the size of Vermont. Wow.
And it's diverse. And that's what I really enjoy after working nationally is that our region includes areas that are akin to the agricultural Great Plains, other areas that are forested and have black bears and are a little wild. And then have small cities and towns that range from bucolic to a little gritty industrial.
So you mentioned land trusts and you explained a little bit about how those differ, but can you talk a little bit more about, so for example, something that I'm familiar with is the Central Park Conservancy. I know that they raise money to protect the park, to take care of it. If it was called the Central Park Land Trust, what would that mean? How would that be different?
Well, in a way, the names are somewhat generic, conservancy or land trust. And the distinction is the Central Park Conservancy helps the city of New York manage that great resource that is a city park. Most land trusts are a little bit different. They actually take title to property and own and manage it on their own. So they may also work like we do in partnership with government. But the distinction is at the end of the day, we have to make sure we build an institution that can uphold the commitments we've made on land that we're committed to in perpetuity. So you find that land trusts in particular pay a lot of attention to endowment growth and ensuring that as they tell a donor today that we're creating this conservation area, that 100 years from now, we expect to still be accessible and well-managed, that's on us versus Central Park. It's more of a shared collaboration.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned endowment because another thing I'm really curious about are the income sources for the Finger Lakes Land Trusts, but also environmental organizations in general. Would you say there are, you know, two or three main income sources, or how do you think about that?
Well, typically, of course, I think like any nonprofit, whatever funds we can get, we get. So a lot depends on the regional variations. Some areas might have a robust foundation community, others not, or some areas, institutions more interested in the environment. Public funding that's not available in one state, maybe in another. But typically, I think land trusts, the lion's share of their operating support comes from individual members or donors. And that's certainly true in our case, where our budget is largely supported by nearly 3,000 families that annually make contributions. We do receive corporate and foundation support, but that is really dwarfed by individuals. And at the same time, in New York State, as well as a number of other states, not so much for operating support, but on individual projects, public funding does play an important role. And where I see around the country the most effective conservation going on, it involves private landowners, nonprofits, but also not just one level of government, frequently a local county government, a state government, sometimes federal. So it's a truly a collaborative approach.
It is staggering, though, to hear how much dependency or need there is from individuals to support these organizations.
Well, on a positive note, after working for the National Association of Land Trusts and working very closely with foundations, as you may have experienced, foundations tend to be a little less reliable over time. A new program manager comes in and the institution has been benefiting from, say, large grants for 4 or 5 years, and you get kind of used to them. And suddenly the program manager goes in a different direction. I think that's a lot less common with individuals who we have donors and members who've been for decades committed to us. So in a way, it would be great to get more foundations, but if I had a choice, I'd rather rely on individuals.
So what do you think about the development side of your job? Of course, you're executive director, so you have all of the responsibilities, but How about that piece? Where does it fit? Do you enjoy it? Tell us.
Well, I do enjoy it. And I started out on the program side of things, working on deals to protect land. And inevitably, it became clear that to achieve what I wanted to achieve, we needed more resources. So I gradually got into first grantsmanship and then took a greater role and ended up where I am today. And I think what I really enjoy the most is the relationships that develop for those longtime donors that you really get to know over time and develop a strong bond with the organization and the diversity of folks you meet. And that's really what I enjoy the most.
Do you make yourself available to all donors, or do you mainly just interact with the board? How do you prioritize your time?
Well, of course, looking at revenue generation, do you have to prioritize based on those needs? But a lot of my time is spent meeting with donors individually, meeting with donors in groups, recruiting new donors from public speaking engagements. So really, most of my time is actually spent externally meeting with folks. And the pandemic has made that, of course, a bigger challenge.
Right. Well, the thing that's very unique about, you know, fundraising for environmental causes is the fact that, and we've kind of talked about this, that you don't have a set group of constituencies. I guess in a way you could say the people that live in your region are technically your constituencies because you all share, you know, this community, this land. But do you think that people who give to the Finger Lakes Land Trust or to other environmental causes are different from other kinds of donors? Do you have any ideas around distinctions there?
Well, I just have theories because my entire career has been, after a brief stint in for-profit marketing, has been in conservation.
So you're a little biased.
Yeah, so I haven't raised money for academia or a hospital.
Yeah.
But from talking to other folks, my own personal experience, I think it seems that we do find, it seems to me, a higher proportion of donors who are very low-key, who like to give anonymously and are very quiet about their giving. And at the same time, it also seems, I've been told this by a fundraising consultant, I believe it, a lot of environmental donors are information junkies. They want a lot of information. And I think that's because a lot of folks are passionate about nature and are very interested in it. So perhaps to a higher degree, they really want details versus some donors, not so much. And at least that's my perception of it.
So are your fundraisers or the folks that work in development for your organization fairly well versed in those details, or do they bring in you or other experts to help with that?
I would say they're well versed to a degree, but no, not to go beyond their knowledge base. So,
right.
Because that would clearly be the way to lose our credibility. So at two levels, sometimes it might be not me, but a program person, whether that's from our land management staff or our land protection staff, teaming them up with them, or on occasion, involving me in some sort of discussion or interaction with donors.
Well, you mentioned credibility. I think that's huge in building trust with donors and building communities. And there are so many different kinds of organizations. I think it can be hard for donors to pick, you know, which ones to prioritize or focus on. And you had mentioned to me this idea, I don't know if it's formal or not, but the idea of the $1 million test, where if someone asks you, I have $1 million, what are you going to do with it? That if you have an answer to that, it proves that you're a strong program. Tell us more about that.
And this goes back to when I worked at the Land Trust Alliance, which a lot of what the Alliance is about is supporting 1,700 nonprofit organizations in different ways. And it would come up, and that $1 million test could be 5 million, 10 million, it's scalable. Mm-hmm. But we would sometimes have small nonprofits say, we have a fundraising problem. And sometimes they legitimately did, but other times they had a program problem because their program wasn't compelling, was the reason they didn't have their act together. Mm-hmm. And I dealing with real estate, you can spend $1 million pretty easily, or for that matter, programmatically these days, not hard to do. So I would give them this test to say, okay, somebody comes up and says, what do you do with $1 million? And a lot of times they would have absolutely no answer. And I, and again, if you are for a larger organization, maybe it's 10 million or something, but it gave a sense of not just maybe the lack of a strategic plan, but also an achievable vision to share with that donor. And I found that to be a good exercise, again, shifting the scale a bit, but just thinking, hey, if things go our way, you know, where do we want to take it? And I found that sometimes the organization was lacking in that. And that speaks volumes to if that opportunity arises, they may not be successful.
Well, as donors are getting more and more sophisticated, my guess is that they're asking those kinds of questions more often.
Oh, absolutely. And we are, you know, keenly aware, not just from a regional basis, but one of the characteristics of the Finger Lakes, where there are 11 lakes that have their differences, but in some ways are similar, is that a lot of our donors may care about the whole region somewhat, but they really are passionate about their lake or watershed. So we have to kind of focus on a sub-regional basis too, or we risk a donor feeling that we're not paying attention to their local concerns.
It's almost like a university in the sense that there's the whole, you know, the land the size of Vermont, but then there are these segments within it where it sounds like you really could slice and dice different gift ideas or programs.
Oh, absolutely. We have to balance the colleges or departments' needs.
Right.
Ours are communities and lakes rather than colleges or departments.
So does your board represent all of those? Let's talk more about the Finger Lakes Land Trust.
It does. We actually have a regionally diverse board that, again, comes from this area about the size of a small state. But it's not meant to be kind of equal representation.
Okay.
Lake or so on. But we do are constantly thinking of how could we be strategic and not spread ourselves too thin, which is a danger, mm-hmm. but also recognizing the legitimate question of if I'm in this particular area, like what did the land trust do for me in the last year or two? So it's a tension between being focusing our efforts and achieving the best success in a particular spot, but also being sensitive that how do you define and address local needs on such a big scale?
Right. Well, what has the COVID response been? I'm assuming that you're remote as an office. Have you been getting donations? Have you been able to have any interactions with donors? How's it going?
It's been challenging, but I think we're a lot better off than some other nonprofits. First, because our work is so much in the field, we were already set up. Most of us work with laptops and cell phones. So it was a relatively easy transition to a remote office. And since the state allowed it, our office is closed to the public, but we don't get a lot of walk-in traffic anyway. Mm-hmm. But some people were able to accommodate people's preferences. So I'm in the office right now and my home is nearby and I prefer it. But other people with different childcare situations and stuff were able to be flexible. We've benefited because we've seen tremendous increase in people getting outdoors. So this is true across the country. So we've seen a bump actually in membership as people have gotten out and appreciated these places versus institutions such as theaters and museums that have been closed.
Yeah, so, it's the opposite effect, right?
Yeah, so we're cautious for the future, but so far we've been doing fine and have made plans for some contingencies, but so far so good.
Do you think that the pandemic has encouraged people to prioritize their local environments more? You know, appreciating the fact that they can walk around and be in nature when they can't be in the office?
Yeah, I think that we have probably introduced a lot of people to our preserves that maybe hadn't been there before or had been there once or twice and really didn't think about the value of having those conserved areas. So we've definitely seen more people valuing our work, which is a silver lining to all this.
Yeah. You mentioned the land trust as being multi-local in another conversation I've had with you, and you've hinted at a little bit today, but can you talk to us about what that means?
We work in an area that's defined by 12 counties. And then as small cities, like I'm in Ithaca today, we have communities such as Corning, New York, where Corning Incorporated is based, number of towns and small cities. And so we have recognized one of our strengths is we have a regional board that's regionally represented, but at the same time, a weakness is we're spread thin. So for example, here in Ithaca, we have a few board members from a networking perspective in the hospital, and then have 16. So we try to focus our staff. We have a 15 member staff, and that includes program as well as development administration. So we're very focused on nurturing connections and prioritizing some communities for both volunteers and staff to do events, receptions, field trips, to recognize the value of personal contact. So part of our annual planning and strategic planning is thinking how to nurture kind of a sense of community for our organization in these localities that are an hour and a half, 2 hours apart. And I liken it to playing 20 games of chess at the same time.
Yeah. How do you prioritize the regions though? Do you do it based on where potential gifts are with donors, or is it really based on the different parts of land?
We start with the natural resources, and the good news is that we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Government agencies, whether that's the state of New York or county planning agencies, have already recognized some of the most important natural areas. So we're just affirming where there's already a lot of consensus. And then we look at resource values, and we don't look just for one value. We work in areas frequently where it's very important for public drinking water, but the Audubon Society has identified its great habitat, has recreational features. So there are certain sites where everyone agrees there are all these values, and that's what really pops up as a priority. Mm-hmm. So then we look at focusing on those and then take threat into account, because some areas are threatened by development and others have very modest threat. And the last is feasibility, both in terms of, are we adding to existing protected land where there's already something to start from? And are we competing in the marketplace for very expensive real estate that's costly to acquire than manage? Or is it something that's far more achievable? So we're looking at all those variables. And on the feasibility side, that includes both private and public funding to not only do the front end of the work, but if we're going to have some kind of ongoing commitment to make sure we can endow it sufficiently.
I didn't even think about the threat piece. You know, which lands are more vulnerable than others?
Yeah, and the Finger Lakes it's a big region. You have areas near the lakes, some of it, and here in Ithaca, they're growing in population, and you see there's probably an opportunity in the next 20 years to conserve certain land that if you don't, that opportunity will be gone. And then there are some vast rural areas in what we call the southern tier on the Pennsylvania border that haven't changed much in the last 20 years and may not change that much in the next 20.
So yeah, that was more of what I was thinking about, was just acres of land that are existing but being taken care of.
Yeah, it's really near the lakes where locally driven, and we see more people coming to the region from afar that are attracted by the lakes and the wineries and the college towns.
So you said you've gained new members, which is fantastic, and you're absolutely right. That is a silver lining. Have you gained new donors? Has there been a correlation?
Well, we don't distinguish at the staff level in a meaningful way. We are a membership organization, but in terms of to the outside, to our members and donors, you'd have to poll them. I think most of them write a check and don't distinguish.
Okay. So
we do have a membership and an appeal in the fall as a system, but I know there are people who are totally focused on this and others that are totally oblivious, and we cash all their checks. So
basically, so for some people, it's like, if you're a member, you're already a donor, but some members are members, but then they give a gift on top of that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So it, to us, it's, we just recognize that we have two types of member donors, some who pay attention to this and others who don't.
Are you working on converting that, or are you okay with it, how it is?
Because the memberships actually have a voting right, and it's one of those things that our annual meeting, you wonder, does anyone really pay much attention to this? But the thought of taking that away from a pure development standpoint, I wouldn't want to find out who cares passionately about that. So we just recognize that at the annual meeting, it doesn't seem to create a lot of passion, but that we have not proposed to take away the vote of our members.
Okay. Well, you have a really strong program, and I know you've worked on some seven-figure gifts, and you have a good pipeline of giving. Can you share a gift or two that you've worked on that was notable or that you think we could learn from?
Yeah, there's one that we just completed that I think is really our strength, where it's a donor. The organization was founded in 1989. And two members, a couple who became members in 1989, have been consistent members all the way through, active volunteers who have worked on our stewardship, our land management programs. And they lived on a property that was a nice house with also acreage associated that we agreed was worthy of conservation. So they donated what's called a conservation easement to limit development while they remained on the land and so on. Well, they retired, and when they moved into a smaller home in a retirement community, they decided to donate their home, their property. And this week sold it to a new buyer. So in this case, the conservation easement is in place. So it is a home with acreage, but it can't be subdivided or further developed. And in this case, it was in the hills outside Ithaca, a very charming, pretty spot. And they really knew what they wanted. They wanted this to benefit what we call our opportunity fund, which is a internal revolving loan fund so we can move quickly in the real estate market. So if land comes up that's on our priority list, we can buy it and then replenish that in time for fundraising. And that was a sale of $390,000 that will be netted to this war chest we have, that really is a kind of a capstone on this couple's years of support of the organization. And I think it just demonstrates that they have been committed to us, they know us, they've volunteered their time. And that, I think, is really our strong suit of folks who have just worked right alongside us and developed a profound understanding of what we do and also a trust with the organization. So we're particularly pleased with that.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Was that something that you were part of in terms of discussing this with the couple, or did they come up with it on their own and just let you know of their plans?
They requested a visit to go over the proposal and how it would work and all that. And there were some additional details of kind of working through, but it was very much it was their idea and then a collaboration on executing, to get their vision.
Have you thought about doing education amongst your constituencies around these kinds of creative gifts?
We do, and we definitely promote them. One advantage we and other land trusts have in this regard is we have expertise in real estate.
Right.
So we have...
you actually know what to do with it, unlike...
Yeah, we close... 15, 16 real estate projects a year. So it's easier for us to do this sort of gift than for a nonprofit that had no real estate expertise and, you know, counsel and so on. And we've been fortunate in recent years, we've been receiving one of these gifts per year. And so it's really helped particularly build endowment and build this revolving.
Yeah, it sounds almost like the people who really are committed or who would say consider the Finger Lakes Land Trust a top three priority philanthropically really know what's going on. Like they really are part of the fabric of the organization.
I would agree. And the where we gain new members or new major donors on the emotional side is, say, on one of these lakes, we're acquiring a last undeveloped shoreline, and you are the neighbor who's never thought about the environment, perhaps, but suddenly we're offering to conserve the land next to you versus seeing a housing development. So we also sometimes get significant gifts that are driven less by an awareness of the organization, what we do, than a particular project enacting an emotion to, or in some cases, frankly, a little bit of self-interest.
Right.
The project happened. And that's where this feasibility comes in, is that it's whether it's a government funder or a rich neighbor that can make the difference on the feasibility of some projects. Fortunately, as we've grown, we've been able to create new resources. So that's allowed us to avoid having a project stopped frequently and where we can only work where there are rich folks. We've been doing actually more in remote areas where we can have a bigger impact because the real estate is cheaper.
Yeah, and it makes sense that that would be the areas by the water, because that's where the more expensive homes are, it's more desirable.
Yep, and one of the challenges that has driven new membership is we and many other parts of the world now are facing increased water quality challenges, particularly from climate change and other factors. And the health of the lakes depends on the health of the land around it. And so we have been reaching out systematically to lakeshore property owners who, as you might imagine, are keenly focused on water quality, the views from their property. And that has been a productive area for us for generating new members.
Is that more expensive in terms of the resources that you need to bring forward as opposed to conserving land?
Well, what we're doing is focusing on the land that's most important for the lakes, and that's still land related, but then getting involved in new restoration projects where we're literally just starting. So for example, creating buffers on streams by planting trees and restoring wetlands. And thus far, most of those have involved partnerships with government conservation agencies. So it hasn't required heavy lifting yet on the fundraising side. But we're still in the early stages, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Well, I think I would be remiss to not ask you the $1 million test on the Finger Lakes Land Trust. What would you guys do with a $1 million gift tomorrow?
Well, I think you'd have to go to 10 or 50. Unfortunately, a million doesn't get you much anymore around here.
Good answer.
And with 11 lakes, I could probably have 11 different answers. But I guess there we've gotten to the point where we have our real estate wish list. And frankly, a lot of what the land trust does is try to cultivate a relationship with an owner, a landowner, just like a donor, but recognize that it may be 20 years before they want to deal with their mortality or their personal finances or children and dealing with the land. And our challenge is, how do we stay connected and not annoy them for the next 20 to 30 years? So we have on the real estate side a long wish list. At the same time, I could spend millions there on the stewardship side of taking care of it and hosting the public and education. We have a whole wish list on the stewardship side. And lastly, specific to water, we have another wish list there. So we have no shortage of ideas for how to spend the money.
Well, it's exciting that you have such a clear vision, and it sounds like going into this year, you have some projects that you're really excited about.
Oh, absolutely.
Good. Well, we're going to have to keep track of you and see how everything's going. Is there anything else you want to share with us before we wrap up?
That one of the things we're doing as an organization as we continue to grow is look at how we can strengthen our connections, because now we actually have a little more capacity. So I mentioned we have 15, we're hiring our 16th staff person. Well, not that long ago, it was more like 8. So we've been adding about a full-time person a year. And that now allows us to look more holistically at, for example, looking at how can we help connect underserved youth in our small cities with some of our naturalers and connect them with nature. How with some of the bigger educational institutions can we look at our common interests? So one thing that's exciting is with a little bit more capacity, we can look at stronger collaboration and more holistically looking at community needs, which I expect will bring us into some new programs and areas that I find really exciting.
Yeah, there's so much that could be done, especially on the youth side when playing outside is becoming less and less common for the younger generations.
Absolutely, and recognizing that in an area that's dominated by the driving around an automobile, there's still some parts of the region where kids, they may not have transportation, can't get out to these beautiful natural areas or to spend time on the lakes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing with us about you, your career, and the Finger Lakes Land Trust. I've certainly learned a lot. Would love to end with our signature question, which is, Andy, what do you know for sure?
Well, I guess I would have to say, because I came from a program background and really overcame some discomfort with, soliciting gifts is, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I still need to remind myself sometime that I still have that extra nudge is from a fundraising standpoint, that if you believe in the work that you're seeking support, to not be shy. And I know sometimes I still have to nudge myself to remind myself that.
Well, it seems like you're so passionate about what you do, and that certainly helps.
No, absolutely. That's my nudge.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you so much.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me, Catherine.
Thank you, Andy, for your insights, your calm nature, pun intended, and your ideas around fundraising for the environment. I look forward to continuing talking about this particular topic. Thank you all for tuning in. You're welcome to connect. I invite your connection through LinkedIn on the group, The Development Debrief, or to email me at devdebrief@gmail.com. Have a great day.